Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where psychology and psychoanalysis meet social justice, feminism, politics, climate change, critical theory, graduate student mental health, and the arts.
Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to bridging the gap between the field of psychology, social issues, and society.
Thank you for joining us.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast. Today I will be speaking with Dr. Leon S. Brenner, who is a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Potsdam, a prospective postdoctoral fellow at the University of Ghent, and a lecturer at the International Psychoanalytic University in Berlin. He is a member of the Association for Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy in Ireland, LOB, and a founder of Lacanian Affinities Berlin, or LaLab, as well as a founder of Unconscious Berlin. His latest book on the subject of the psychoanalysis of autism is called The Autistic Subject, On the Threshold of Language, where he presents a novel account of the autistic subjectivity from a Lacanian psychoanalytic perspective. This is the first of a two-part series that will explore Lacanian psychoanalysis, the unconscious, and subjectivity from a Lacanian perspective. Part 2 will cover Dr. Brenner's book, The Autistic Subject, On the Threshold of Language, which will be released as a separate episode. We hope you can tune into both episodes, as we will cover several topics that might be of interest to psychologists, mental health professionals, or anyone who has an interest in Lacanian psychoanalysis. As always, thank you for your continued support and your interest in the Unconventional Dyad Podcast.
Currently, you can say I'm working between the academy and the clinic. I'm working as a researcher in two universities, and I'm doing research on autism. One here in Berlin and another in Belgium, in the University of Ghent. And there we're starting a very exciting project of an autism research group. Hopefully we'll be able to have some impact in Europe. What's unique about this group is the fact that it is strictly psychoanalytically oriented. This is something quite unique that we're starting there. And I hope I'll have some more news for you, Carly, as the year progresses. Hopefully this will be a better year than the previous one. Otherwise, I work in the clinic in what is called a Lacanian orientation after the psychoanalyst, named after the psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, if you say it in the French accent. But I think in the American accent, you say Lacan, right? How would you say it?
It depends on where you are in the U.S.
Lacan, exactly, Lacan. Yeah. So this is the guy. And this is my orientation in general, in my research and in the clinic itself. I'm also leading several groups in Berlin that have to do with psychoanalysis and Lacan. One of them is a very interesting, vibrant group of people that are not necessarily clinicians, many artists, students, just general people that enjoy psychoanalysis. And this group is called Lacanian Affinities Berlin. We call ourselves LaLab. And we have many activities, and maybe we can leave a link down under the podcast for the website. So we do a lot of stuff, and we have this zine that we publish about our work, and it's quite interesting. And another group that I work with is called Unconscious Berlin. And this is quite a new initiative where we try and see how we can get a very intricate and deep psychoanalytic thought and ideas out there into the street, using a contemporary design language and trying to make it, let's say, more contemporary in this sense, and not closed up in these small groups of academics or practitioners that sort of hold a secret and then nobody can have access to it. So this is the Unconscious Berlin project. And some more stuff, I have to say, it's been a very productive year being locked at home, being forced to do the work. Generally speaking, I can say that this is generally what I'm doing lately.
That's great. And we can put all those links in the episode notes. There are several of them that I want people to be able to get their hands on. So what got you interested in Lacan? When did you become kind of affiliated with him? And what interested you?
So this is a more of a personal story, but we can say we can discuss some of it, I guess. My interest in psychology was always there, and I was very interested in Freud from a very young age. I then went to study psychology in the university, but actually the lack of depth and sort of the what I felt was a bit of an intellectual desert drove me off into studying a philosophy for my second degree. And as I was doing that, getting more and more into what is called in philosophy phenomenology and existentialism, which find a way to intersect with psychology by many thinkers, I completely accidentally stumbled upon Lacan. And that was love at first sight. And we've been constantly fighting ever since. But this is our relationship. It's lovely. It's wonderful. And it's extremely fruitful. It works, like Woody Allen says. You know, eventually you have to find something that works. And with Lacan, it works exactly because it doesn't, in the sense that you're never left with this let's say, one type of satisfaction that you can be left with when you read a specific text, which are very clear, constructed, and sort of impose or even pretend to have some complete totalizing knowledge behind them. So for Lacan, it was quite explicit for him to say that there is no knowledge of all knowledges. There is no language of all languages. There is no point where knowledge becomes self-transparent and full. And his teaching abides by that. And the fact that it is, on the one hand, fragmented, but on the other hand, is extremely productive and fruitful, and you can do so much with it without being able to say, oh, now I know what Lacan exactly was meaning when he started and when he ended, right? This is not to say that, I spend many hours a day trying to read and explain and turn his teaching into something productive for us today. So I'm not an obscurantist in this sense. And there's some psychoanalysts that, you know, abide by that, sort of being obscure, mysterious, and by that sort of, okay, I'm done with the work. So this is not so much how I would describe my work, but I do have an appreciation for the style and the way that, let's say, knowledge is constructed in Lacan's discourse, which I think makes it unique. And this is something that we always have to ask ourselves when we call ourselves psychoanalysts or when we are interested in psychoanalysis. What is unique about it? Why do we need it? There's so many types of therapies, of healings, of coachings. There's so many ways today someone can sort of deal or manage their lives. And why do we need psychoanalysis then? Right? What is unique about it? Does it have something that all these other fields don't have? And well, I truly think there is. And I think that Lacan is one of the one of the psychoanalysts that excelled in accentuating this singular facet of psychoanalysis. That, well, you know, it's after you read Lacan, you spend time with his teaching for so long, you just realize retroactively that it has been in Freud all along. Yeah, so this is how I stumbled upon that, and I've been remaining in this field ever since, because I truly find it extremely useful and fruitful in my life and in my work.
It's so interesting. Here in the States, I think Lacan is more commonly known in the humanities. I think very rarely do we talk about him in our psychology courses, and there are not many Lacanian psychoanalysts here in the States. So I think here he's much more well known in the humanities, which is where I was introduced to him, you know, 15 years ago, and I've become reintroduced to him a few years ago, and I've become very interested in his writing and other people's writing about Lacan. So when you're thinking about Lacan, where do you start? Where do you start with Lacan?
Wow. you open one of the seminars. It's interesting because I get this question a lot, especially from students. They, well, where should I start? Where should I start? You know, Lacan gave about 25 seminars that are all printed in French, some of them in English, and then there's a huge essay collection called Écrit. And these are the only texts that Lacan actually, let's say, wrote down. This means they're much more complex because he actually spent time in articulating them à la lettre, so letter by letter. So yeah, where do you start with Lacan? Let's choose a point to start with today. So maybe we can start, well, maybe you can start politically. You know, it's a political time in the United States, I think, and many things are happening right now. So maybe we can talk a little bit about the politics of psychoanalysis at the time of Lacan. And you've mentioned quite accurately that Lacan is much more well known or referred to in the humanities rather than in psychology departments. It's true, Lacan had a huge effect on intellectual thought. He was contemporary to many, many important thinkers in Europe, especially in France, and he kept in close contact with many of them, teaching in the same universities and going around the same circles. So Lacan's ideas had effect on philosophy, on film theory, on feminism, on so many different fields. And I think, well, they found something productive about it, taking something from psychoanalysis, you know? Which I think this is full, and we see that happening everywhere along history. You know, sometimes art is political. Sometimes science has to have some intersection with art, you know. So we see these fields interacting and sort of learning one from another. So you see that in the humanities. But Lacan was not a philosopher, and this is something that was very important for him to stress, and also very important for Lacanians today to stress. That Lacan's psychoanalysis is not a philosophy. Lacan was a psychiatrist, born in the beginning of the 20th century. And what was interesting about him from the beginning is that he started by dealing with psychosis. You know, Freud was very interested in hysteria at the time, where he did write some papers on psychosis, but he never got to write a comprehensive account on psychosis, but did provide us with some clues and hints as to his work. Well, first of all, he didn't have a lot of cases to work on. And second, he was, and this, you can see that in some of his letters, he was a bit suspicious. I'm talking about Freud. He was a bit suspicious as to the capacity of psychoanalysis to do anything or to deal with psychosis in general. And Lacan started his career and wrote his doctoral thesis on his work with psychosis. So many, many pages of extremely interesting case studies and theorizations on psychosis, which culminated eventually into his third seminar on psychosis, which, again, you asked me where to start, an excellent point to start. And then to his later theory on psychosis in the 70s, which is completely different. But when we go to the humanities, you know, you always hear the mirror stage. They always mention the mirror stage. This is, I think, one of the most known metapsychological models that Lacan developed in the English-speaking world. Right? This was one of the first ones translated, and people are very interested in it. I think it's catchy in its first rendition. By the way, it has several later renditions after that time. And Lacan himself presented this paper at a conference of the International Psychoanalytic Association, and he didn't receive a very good response from the crowd. Now, why politics? Because this piece, while being extremely interesting in its first version, I think it was in 1936, was first presented and only later on published in the 40s. But this piece is extremely political. It's extremely political. And again, I think it's fortunate to talk about it. And I've mentioned being excited of being hosted here in a podcast situated in the United States, because it's political. This presentation about the mirror stage is political exactly in the American context. Because Lacan presents it at the time where, after the Second World War, many psychoanalysts found their refuge in the United States, especially Jewish psychoanalysts that were persecuted and found their place in the United States. It was a very exciting time for psychoanalysis in the United States, and especially for what is known as the school of ego psychology. So this paper is presented as sort of a polemic against the school of ego psychology developed in the United States at the time. Now, without getting too much into the itty-gritty of stuff, we can do it, but maybe we'll stay general because we've just started speaking. The mirror stage talks about the certain, let's say we can call it a process or a certain mode of structuration in the psyche that Freud called the ego. And Lacan provides the mirror stage as a way to readdress the ego and provide it with different coordinates, in opposition to the school of ego psychology, which put a great emphasis on the strengthening of the ego and put the ego in the center stage. What Lacan generally develops in this model is the idea that the ego is actually not so central in the psychoanalytic treatment and in general in the psyche. Now, this is not going too far from Freud, because Freud said that quite explicitly. The ego is not a master in his own house. And he also said that the ego is not the first construct in the psyche. And Melanie Klein commented on that. He said, well, he was talking about the id or the drive. There is something there before the ego is formed. And what Lacan is saying eventually is that psychoanalysis is distinguished because it doesn't put the ego at center stage, but it puts something else there, which Lacan calls the subject. So in direct opposition to the school of ego psychology, Lacan was saying the ego, in fact, is an imaginary construct that does not even provide us with any sense of selfhood, which is self-transparent and consistent, but with a certain semblance of consistency, which is secondary in nature in the psyche. So if we take that into account, we can sort of relax a bit when dealing with the ego, and also orient the clinic not to treating the ego, strengthening it, but to asking questions, not so much about what is said by a person about himself, but what is not said about this subject. And maybe I'll just finish with this short rant with something from Lacan, that he says, well, we can see that in the way that our patients speak, and the way speech speech engages with the question of desire. So he bases himself on Freud's paper from 1925 called Negation, which I think is one of Freud's most philosophical texts ever written. And in this paper, Freud says, well, you know, sometimes, and he gives an example, I had this patient and I was not even asking him anything. He was recounting his dream and I didn't even say anything. And he talked about this woman in the dream. And then he automatically, without any anything told by me, he was saying, yes, but this woman in my dream, Dr. Freud, is not my mother. Forget about it. Yeah. And Freud is saying, well, you know, I didn't say anything. I didn't imply anything. And the mere fact that we have here sort of a very voluntary form of negation points out or directs us towards something that is interesting for the analysis. So it's not so much the, let's say, if we read Freud stupidly, yes, it would be, oh, yes, it is his mother. But this is not what Freud refers to, because he also says that explicitly. It's not so much that it is his mother in the dream. It is the fact that a negation is the hallmark of a repression. So a negation is the hallmark of something that is unconscious, that is interesting for us, again. So when a patient says something like, I do not desire that, we can understand it in two ways. And you need to study just a little bit of linguistics in order to see this. We can understand this as a transitive sentence, as a sentence that has an object. And in this sense, the patient is saying, I do not desire this object, object A. I do not desire this specific thing. But then we can also understand it in an intransitive way, sort of a sentence with no object. And we see that by saying, I do not desire, the patient is in fact saying, it is not I that desires, but it is it. And I think this is the basis of so many complaints that we see in the clinic, especially with neurotics. I don't want to fail in university, but every time I have a test, I can't wake up. I want to have a relationship. I want to find love and get married. But every time a relationship gets serious, I dump my partner, right? So again, we see here exactly what is at stake in psychoanalysis. Not so much an ego talking about himself and the things that he wants, but a speech which unravels some unconscious desire, which causes trouble, causes suffering, and is the object of psychoanalytic inquiry in the clinic. This unconscious desire is what Lacan associates with the subject. And this is what he offered as an alternative to ego psychology, a psychoanalysis which revolves the question of the subject of the unconscious rather than the speaking ego.
If we continue with the conversation about the unconscious, how would you explain Lacan's understanding of the unconscious?
So this is a great question. Because the answer is great. A lot of people think of the unconscious, and you see that in popular media, and you see that also in very important psychoanalytic texts and psychological texts, because, you know, saying the unconscious is something that everybody says today. It's a word that everybody shares. You know, we have to remember at the time of Freud, it was a magnificent invention. Freud invented it, yes, the unconscious, the unbewusst in German. And many people view the unconscious as this very dark, deep cave hidden somewhere in the psyche. And, you know, you need to really dig deep into the psyche in order to find it. And I would say this, I call this perspective the maybe the theological perspective on the unconscious. To me, it smells of theology. Certain belief in this unseen, deep place of truth. But for Lacan, I think the unconscious is secularized. This does not say that it is secular, but it is secularized. In what way? There is an aphorism that is well known in whoever was acquainted with Lacan a little bit. There is an aphorism from Lacan. He says, the unconscious is structured like a language. This is something that Lacan says, and I truly agree with that. What this means, in fact, is that Lacan argues that the unconscious is not this deep, hidden cave somewhere in the depth of the psyche, but it is a place where elements of language are inscribed. So how do we understand that? We can try and understand it when thinking about repression. Repression is a very important term, concept in psychology and psychoanalysis in general, because repression constitutes the unconscious. Right? Without repression, there is no unconscious. So what Freud said about repression, quite simply, and we have to remember that the theory is more complex because there is a primal repression and then there is a secondary repression. What we mostly know is the secondary one, the one Freud also calls repression as defense. In German, it's called Abwehr. And this is the defense that gave birth to the theory of defense mechanisms, again, in the English-speaking schools of psychoanalysis. Now, repression, quite simply, according to Freud, is a mechanism that functions in as much as an idea comes to the psyche. An idea is sort of perceived in the psyche, and an idea is, according to Freud, accompanied by a quota of affect. And when we have an idea, we have a corresponding affect accompanied with it. And Freud was saying that when this quota of affect is so extreme and so unpleasurable that it's just too much, let's say, for the ego to handle, then repression happens, taking the idea, separating it from this quota of affect, and pushing it into the unconscious, putting it in the unconscious, right? So by only basing ourselves on this, we can still say, well, maybe the unconscious is this deep hidden place, like we have this very known iceberg diagram, deep underwater, whereas what is left in consciousness is right there in the air. But Lacan looks at it a bit differently, but says that you can find that in Freud. And I really agree, and I'm always happy to see and to be proven wrong. As you can probably guess, it didn't happen too many times, yes? But it sometimes. So for Lacan, what is repressed is not so much an idea, but what he calls a signifier. So a signifier is element of language. It's an element that, let's say, creates meaning. It is through signifiers that the world unravels as meaningful. So we have this piece of language which creates a meaning which is unpleasurable enough, let's say. And this piece of language is not deleted from the psyche, but is not just pushed into a dark place. It is just inscribed in an other place. This is what Freud also called an andere Schauspiel. So this is a Schauplatz. This is another place, right? Another locus. Yeah. So the idea is that the unconscious is not this deep, heavy, deep, dark cave, but another place where signifiers can be inscribed. Or if we go back to Freud, it's just another place for ideas. Now, this other place, it has different a different structure, and it works in a different way. So if we talk about, let's say, conscious language, or the language of the ego, the language of a person talking about himself, this language has specific laws and rules. These rules enable you to understand what I'm saying, hopefully, and me understanding your questions, and we can have a discussion and at least feel that we understand each other. Because we can open a dictionary and we can see what this word means for everybody and how we can put it in a sentence. So we can say consciousness is also structured like a language, but it is the language that we speak between us right now. Now, the unconscious is a more personalized, singular language because it is constructed in one psyche, right? Of course, in relation to society, in relation to this language that we speak, because the words, the signifiers that are repressed still come from this language that is from the outside. We didn't invent them. We are born into the world which already has a language, already has meanings. We are born into a world where we already have a name that is based on a certain language that exists before us. But the unconscious is structured using this material, but then this material works and interacts with each other in a different way. Freud gave us a clue as to these rules that govern the functioning of the unconscious. He called them condensation and displacement. This he talks about in his book on dream analysis, on the interpretation of dreams. So we have all these language elements which exist in consciousness and exist in the unconscious, but function according to different laws and in relation to different language elements. And this makes a lot of sense because, you know, let's have a very, let's say, crude example. Let's say, you know, they always show this in a BA of psychology of this poor kid that they gave him this rat, this white rabbit or something, and they really scared him. What's his name? Do you remember? Yeah. They, little something. I don't think it's not little Hans. This is from Freud. Yeah, it's a little someone. And they gave him some, this is the time of behaviorism. And they gave him this white rabbit and they made a really loud noise and he was really frightened. And beforehand, he was really happy having these white furry animals around him. But after this, whenever he saw this white rabbit, he began to cry. Okay, so this is a very crude example. So we can say something traumatic created a sort of a symptomatic behavior, you know, this fear or anxiety from furry white animals. So again, very crudely, and this is not how things actually are in the psyche, but just to illustrate what I'm trying to say about the unconscious in Lacan is that we can say that something about a white rabbit was repressed. Yeah? Was repressed into the unconscious. But then we cannot say that this person cannot think about white rabbits. He can consciously think about white rabbits. Now, if these ideas were repressed and then pushed into this dark cave, then we won't have access to them anymore, right? They would be out of the access of consciousness. But we can still talk about white rabbits And, you know, people that are traumatized can still talk about their trauma, can still talk about the trauma itself with, and even though there was a very strong repression taking place at the time. So what this shows us is that while an idea or a language element is inscribed in the unconscious, it doesn't delete it from consciousness. It just means that in the unconscious, it will work differently than we expect it to work in consciousness. And this is why this child, in a peculiar way, was quite afraid of white furry animals from that day on. And why we see people, and this is just from lately, from speaking with people outside of the clinic, you know, people are afraid of glitters. I've heard of a person that vomits whenever they see a specific kind of crayon color. So, I mean, all of these behaviors obviously have nothing to do with the dictionary definition of these words and from what we can consciously say about them, but has to do with this specific way this word operates within the unconscious in association and in relationship with different elements that have been repressed as well. So this is a general way to see in a rudimentary explanation of how the unconscious is or how it functions according to Lacan. The examples, I hope, illustrate the way that Lacan refers to the unconscious and I believe Freud as well. The unconscious is structured like a language exactly because it is composed of linguistic elements associating one with another according to specific laws of syntax that are singular to the unconscious. Now, again, what makes psychoanalysis unique is that in the clinic, we do not listen to our patients in the way that I am listening to you or you are listening to me at this point in order to try to understand. What we listen to is not so much to what is spoken, but we try to listen to what is exactly not spoken, realizing that what is not spoken does not speak according to the laws that govern the language, the conscious language that we use in order to understand each other. So this makes it quite a unique practice and even quite a difficult one. As Freud says, one of the impossible professions.
Mm-hmm. Do you mind if I ask you one more? It might be a bit of a big question, so we can see where this takes us. Can you share a little bit about what Lacan, how he understands subjectivity, how he understands relationship with one another? How does he?
Okay, well, this is a very big question, and it has several answers, of course. In Lacan's teaching, which changes from time to time. Maybe I can relate to it. I can answer this question from the perspective which I take in my latest book that I wrote. I wrote a book about autism, and the book is called The Autistic Subject. And the book obviously deals with the question of subjectivity. what we can call subjectivity from this, let's say, prism, or this sort of section that we cut out from Lacan's teaching, is something that is quite similar to what Freud called a mental structure. So Freud went and met patients at the clinic. And he met them and he tried to deduce something from these meetings. You know, this is what another thing which distinguishes psychoanalysis from philosophy, because philosophers go to the library and think about concepts and develop them in a certain vacuum, whereas psychoanalysts have to get dirty and meet actual subjects in the clinic. And, you know, things change in society and people change. And today we have, you know, at least in the Lacanian orientation, there are new clinical categories and new clinical ideas that grew from the changes that we see in society. When society changes, the subject changes. And this is why psychoanalysis is not so much an edifice that is focused on creating a universal knowledge that will be true forever, whereas philosophy is. Yeah. So Freud was oriented to meet his patients, but nevertheless to do something which is general. So it would be quite difficult to say that every single person is utterly unique. Treating one person cannot be the same as treating another, which has some truth to it, something which I agree with. But then something has to be generalized in order to have an edifice, a technique, a knowledge. Yeah. And what Freud was noticing were different behaviors, different ways of speaking, and what he later called symptoms. So different symptom formations. And what Freud tried to do is to compile at least a short list of these general subtypes of, let's say, human existence, human being, human suffering. And what Freud did, he compiled a list of three such mental structures. He talked about neurosis, he talked about perversion, and he talked about psychosis. And these were the three major mental structures. What was very much unique about Freud's approach to these mental structures, he didn't associate them strictly with the behavior or the apparent symptoms that one sees in the clinic. So, you know, today when a person goes and sees a psychiatrist, they do a reality check. Right, I hear that a lot, the misuse of this term, reality testing, as though this has something to do with the reality principle, which you see in Freud, which I really don't think so. But, you know, they ask you, so what day is it today? What's your name? There are ways to very quickly diagnose a psychosis. If a person hallucinates or has delusions, it's very easy. It's even, I think, some people find it pleasurable. Diagnosis is pleasurable, both for the person making the diagnosis and the one receiving it. But the question is if this is not just a sort of a sadomasochistic kind of relationship that is formed there. But what Freud was doing is sort of resisting this. And saying, I don't think that we should determine a mental structure according to the apparent symptoms and behaviors that we see in patients, because there are so many similarities. And when he went really deeply into the way that these behaviors manifest, he saw that structurally they're so similar. You know, they're so similar. He said, well, what we should associate with a mental structure is a underlying psychic mechanism. Now, immediately we say repression. Repression is the first one. Yeah, repression is an underlying psychic mechanism. And what Freud in a way said is that repression is not only associated with neurosis, repression is the cause of neurosis. So when we see repression, we diagnose neurosis. So what we're interested in psychoanalysis is more this mechanism, how it works, where to identify it, what are its effects, rather than, oh, a person, you know, has OCD. OCD is we can sort of diagnose through a list of behaviors and sort of say, okay, so this is a neurotic, or this is neurotic behavior, or this is obsessive compulsive behavior. For Freud, it would be going to the mechanism that enabled these behaviors to manifest in the first place. So he associated repression with neurosis, and eventually there's a few more. There's disavowal, which is associated with perversion, sometimes with psychosis. Again, I said his account of psychosis is not fully comprehensive. And then we have what he called rejection associated with psychosis. All of these mechanisms are the cause of a mental structure. And in this sense, we can say that what Lacan was doing is he was taking Freud's account of a mental structure and providing it with a linguistic twist. So it's not so much that repression is just a psychic mechanism, it's a linguistic mechanism. It's a mechanism that has to do with these material, with these elements of language, and through its operating on these elements, it creates a structure. So for Lacan, it's a structure. For Freud, it's a mental structure. For Lacan, it's a subjective structure. So the subject, when we view it in this structural way, can be structured as neurotic, perverse, or psychotic subject. In my book, I venture to argue that there is a fourth subjective structure that's called autism, and I work a lot in order to provide us with some compelling evidence and theory. But then I want to just, before we continue, make a certain reservation here. I personally don't think that the psychoanalytic discourse as it unravels in the clinic or in its use in analysis is useful in this way outside of analysis. So, yes, I think it's useful for the humanities, like you said, but they're doing something completely different. Yeah? In this sense, what I want to suggest is that while a patient or a subject that comes to analysis becomes a subject when seated on the sofa, when lying on the sofa and engaging in analysis, becomes a subject in this way, and in the clinic, the subject can be neurotic, perverse, or psychotic, it is not so much that when this person, now I call it a person, yeah, exits the clinic and goes home, he remains a neurotic structure. In the sense, people are people, and outside of the clinic, they do many things. I think when we call them neurotic, it's more like a colloquial way. It's more like I was mentioning Woody Allen. You know, there's a huge pleasure in his work and his work with psychoanalysis, and he created using that. But the way that at least I view these structures is as coordinates for analysts to work in the clinic. So neurosis, or when a subject is diagnosed or determined as neurotic, it is what helps the analyst direct the treatment. Yeah. This is the use of this notion of subjectivity. Yeah. The subject is there in the clinic. It has to be there because we are dealing with it. We are working with it. But then when a person exits the clinic and goes on to have his own life, I'm not sure what's the value of this subject there, right? Saying this is, I think, philosophical blasphemy for those of my colleagues that in philosophy, because for them, the subject has to exist outside of the clinic because there's something universal about it. While I think it is a useful thing, and these philosophers do very good use with this notion, I think that you've asked me about Lacan's notion of subjectivity. So I think the subject for Lacan is the one that is there in the clinic and through which we can direct the treatment in the clinic.
It reminds me a little bit of a film. So you're watching a film, and as the scene changes, you have this idea in your mind that it's a continuation based on the scenes. So as a subject comes into your office, the subject leaves, it still exists, but we just use the wording to kind of describe how the patient is, the types of symptoms that they're having. It just reminds me a lot of a film. Like we assume that the film is continuous, though it has many different scenes.
I think it's exactly true. The subject subsists in its existence in the duration of analysis. And this is something that's extremely crucial in Lacanian analysis, and something that if you ask around, usually people which are not Lacanian, they, and you say, well, I am I work with patients in this orientation, and they will immediately say, oh, you have this changing interval. You know, you end the session in a different time. And that's true. That's a part of the Lacanian technique. But I think there's so many other things which are so much more important than the technique. And one of them is the idea that the most important variations and work analysis does not necessarily happen in the clinic itself. It happens between sessions. What happens in the session is that this material is brought into the analysis and uttered and spoken, but then the associations, they happen in dreams, they happen in fantasies that unravel on the way to the analyst, or taking the train back and missing your station, right? So this is where the subject persists in its existence. And I think this is something interesting, because analysis has to end at some point. And I think that one way to look at the end of analysis is to look at it as a point of, a terminus for this subsistence of the subject, a certain deflation of our fantasy, which grows and grows as we keep on going to analysis, our fantasy about this subject. A point where this subject is not so much, becomes not so much a living companion, but a bundle of words and desires that have to do with your symptom. Yeah. So in a way, we can say that the end of analysis is also the point where we leave the subject, and this is when we put it with a capital S and with this glory and this mystery, we leave it with the analyst in the clinic and set off to have our own life with a certain enthusiasm or even cynicism as tools. Yeah.
I have one last question for you. Can you share some of your hopes for the future? What do you plan on doing next? What are some of your interests that you would like to continue cultivating?
Okay, Carly, you ask difficult questions. I like it. So again, my hopes for the future. Let's say one of my major hopes, and this hope underlies a lot of the work that I do today, is that we will be able to take psychoanalysis outside of the closed-off, even guild-like institutions, and reappropriate it from the form it has been, this form that has preserved it so far. So I was saying this is something, you know, taking psychoanalysis, taking it out to the street, taking it, making it relevant. Yeah. So of course I think psychoanalysis is relevant from my own experience, if it's my own experience in analysis or the experience that I have with other people, and I see the dramatic effect this discourse has on people's lives. But let's say my hopes and wish and my biggest hope would be to find a way for this discourse to subsist outside of these closed off institutions. So in a way, it is an opposite outcome of a personal analysis. Yeah. Whereas in an analysis, the subject remains at the end, the fantastical subject remains in the clinic. What I hope for psychoanalysis is for it to exit this domain, this even I would say even a little jail, and be effective and rejuvenated and revived in contemporary approach to the psyche that we see today. And this will involve very hard work by people that are willing to resist the temptation of these institutes and are able to invent something new. Yeah, so I think this would be the goal of the numerous projects I take part in today, and taking it very seriously, I think.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. That actually is quite a hopeful inspiration. So I want to thank you for being with us today, and I hope that our listeners got a chance to,
of course,
get to know
my pleasure
a little bit more, and maybe a little bit about your work too. So
my mind's too loud for me.